well for any bloody thing they care to pin on it. Well, hello, Janik, I said, sarcasm lining my voice. How was Honeyhall? The pious hermits of Cornville are a bunch of filthy, self-important, ignorant rubes who mistake their ruminations on their own digestion for the cosmic secrets of the universe, Janik said, heading for my wine without invitation. Their understanding of the nature of poetry, much less the poetry of nature, is appalling, he snorted. I can take the petty criticisms of the common public, understand? Leucemanon knows how often I've endured the critiques of the ignorant, he fumed, invoking the old imperial god of poetry. But there's a special, horrific suffering in your soul that occurs when some idiot who feels the hands of a god on his shoulders, telling him what a special little boy he is, tells you that your understanding of the intricate craft you have devoted your life to, nay, that your entire line has devoted its essence to, for generations, to the effect of subtly managing the listener's most primal emotions, is lamentably predictable and lacking in originality due to its adherence to traditional forms. Minolan, he said accusingly, taking an impressive sip from his cup. Ignorant admirers I can contend with, my lord, but I cannot work with conceited amateurs who wouldn't know a metaphor if it was actively chewing on their scrotum. How fares the war? He asked, with genuine interest. We're hopelessly outnumbered and likely to get harshly smitten. On the bright side, our cheese should be of surpassing quality for a few years. So the hermits are useless? I ventured cautiously. I'd come to understand that Janik used dramatic presentation as adeptly as any professional relies on a tool of their craft. Not useless, perhaps, he sighed, but completely horrid as sacred poets. Don't get me wrong, he said, after another healthy sip from his cup. I appreciate any man's sincere dedication to the divine, in whatever manifestation takes his fancy. But the majority of the hermits of Cornville are as bereft of poetic talent as an ugly maiden is bereft of suitors. Well-meaning, but as close to what I do as a water witch is to what the spellmonger does. Nice bit of flattery there, I acknowledged, raising my glass. Thank you. It's nice to be appreciated, he said sincerely, but automatically. Perhaps you can turn them into a service order of some sort, or encourage them to contemplate nature far, far away from your pretty town, Minolan, but do not depend upon the rustic monks to produce a single verse of anything that isn't utterly banal. Really, a god of goats and spiderwebs and mushrooms pretends to understand the intricate noble nature of the human intellect's ability to find the sublime in the natural. Someone, somewhere in history, was drinking way too fucking much with his face pressed drunkenly into the underbrush one horrific night, is what I think, he proposed. Nice fellows, I suppose, but crap poets, he pronounced. But can they be integrated into Vanador? I asked. I don't care if their verse is theologically valid or even reasonably entertaining. I just need to know if they are worthy of expulsion from my realm or indulgence. They'll behave, Janik sighed, at least in my opinion. I gave them a good talking to, he related, as he found his way to a chair and flung himself bonelessly into it, one leg cocked over the arm. I showed them what real poetry can do when it's used properly. I may have made an impression to a few, he considered, but my goal was to give them purpose within human society. I did my best to bridge the gap betwixt the raw adoration of nature, in all of its grimy glory, and the subtle allure of culture and its civilizing impulse. One need not embrace the banal portions of the latter at the expense of the sublime essence of the former, he declared. So, you gave them an intellectual construct for rectifying their desire for nature and their relationship to the rest of mankind, I proposed. What? Janik asked, surprised. No. No, I completely buried them in bullshit. Great heaping, steaming gobs of it, he said, with a note of both pride and disgust in his voice. Dear gods, I haven't spun that much moonshine since I was nicked by one of the black skulls back in the Umbra. Suspicious devils, those, he added. But these reeking rustic rubes, they were leaning on every note once I established my superior craft. So I buried them in so much crap that they were begging me to give them purpose, beyond learning the smallest thing about poetry. What purpose was that? I asked. Professional curiosity, I explained. To be the conduits through which nature influences culture, and the means by which culture observes nature and transforms it into art. All completely aligned with their previous theological perspective, understand, he said, using the wine cup in his hand for emphasis. My sermons did not dispute the religious genius of their historical tradition, he assured. I came not as a prophet, but as an interpreter. Instead, he continued, I grafted on to the goat god's essential message with an interpretation of law. The role of the hermit of Corneville is to demonstrate the essential art of nature to civilization and act as an advocate for nature's protection against the excesses of human endeavor. So, how does that manifest in a practical and hopefully useful way? I asked. Janik sighed wearily. Thankfully, the Lord of Corneville includes a couple of episodes where the goat god offers wisdom and assistance to various moronic worshippers. Half the time it's just an excuse for a veiled dirty joke, or some obvious bit of folk wisdom told in clever verse. Hopelessly banal, he criticized, but occasionally useful. I rewrote a few, dressed them up with some decent meter, and emphasized human compassion and the benevolence of nature, or some shit like that, when I told them. How were they received? I asked, intrigued. They were captivated, of course. I'm a child of Rish, after all, and they were rank amateurs. I know my craft, and they were an ideal audience. Once I beat it into their stinking heads that I was so far better than they, that they really had no other choice but to think me a genius. So what do you think they'll do, after your musical domination? I chuckled. They'll be stretcher-bearers and tenders of the wounded, he sighed. They'll fetch and carry for the medics and the apothecaries. They'll gather what needs to be gathered from the wood. Comfort for the dying, compassion for the wounded, that sort of thing, he dismissed. I appreciate your indulgence, Janik, I said sincerely. That's one less rock in my shoe while I'm marching to battle. Thank you. Just doing my part now that I can't spy anymore, he shrugged. After Honey Hall, I almost miss it. I was constantly terrified and in danger, but there was something about it, he said, shaking his head. Who said you couldn't spy? I asked, realizing that the answer to a problem was staring me in the face. What do you mean? He asked, confused. I'm not going back into the bloody penumbra, he warned, not without an army behind me, or preferably in front of me. I burned too many sources when I left. Had to. Of course, I soothed. But there's intelligence gathering, at which you excel, and there is counter-intelligence, I explained. One of my men caught three spies, three really, really bad spies, in Vanador recently. I wonder how many we haven't caught. Likely because we don't have anyone dedicated to looking for them, I pointed out. You want me to look for spies? He asked, amused. You're particularly well suited to the task, I insisted. You range across the mage lore now, entertaining and watching the populace. You listen to the gossip in 100 places. You're doing half of the job now, I reasoned. All you need to do is make an effort to purposefully cultivate sources, collect reports, and secure a small staff to help organize and analyze it. And I think you'll do a fine job. At the expense of the county exchequer, I added. Then keep watch for us. Report to Mavone, or me, if you'd like. It's a tempting offer, considered the minstrel. Why would you trust me with that task? Because you're devoted to the Wilderlands already, so I don't have to depend on your patriotism. Your knowledge of the region is unmatched. You understand the local politics better than anyone. You speak fluent Givani and understand the nature of our foes. And if you were a coward, you never would have survived the penumbra. You suspect more spies are scouting you? He asked, after studying his wine cup for a moment. Of course. I'd be disappointed if there weren't. The three knights we caught were sent by Count Anvaram of Nyon. I'd be shocked if Shakathet didn't have at least a few human turncloaks watching our preparations. Karakush is still out there. And then there's the family, I said. Then I explained who the family was and who Mother was. And I informed them of our new Duchess's relationship with her former cadre of assassins, who were responsible for the death of the previous Duke and Duchess of Alshar, her in-laws. When I was done, Janik shuddered. So that's the bloodthirsty bitch who rules us all now? Janik asked, shaking his head. My dad never liked Grendine. He met her once at Verone when she was a girl. He played at the palace that summer and she snubbed him as a rustic jongleur. Dad never liked her after that. He'd like her less now, I agreed. If it's any comfort, the longer she wears the crown, the harder it bears on her. I sometimes regret my role in their ascendancy, but I console myself about all of the good that arose from it. Sometimes we bargain with the darkness to preserve the light, the Rish agreed grimly. I've done that too often myself, skulking about in the penumbra over the years. I'd like to think I saved more than I damned, but that's for the gods to decide, I suppose. I think you will find them largely unhelpful in that regard, I said, shaking my head with a mirthless chuckle. In my case, it was the only way I could stop the invasion from plunging into the Riverlands and destroy the power of the censorate over the Magi. Rad isn't too bad, actually, I proposed. He's a decent leader, but even he takes care not to cross Mother unnecessarily. And how is your relationship with the murderous old hag? Janik inquired cheerfully. We keep each other at arm's length. We don't like each other, but we occasionally use each other. We are both committed to the success and security of the realm, although I'd wager how we both define that open to interpretation. In her case, it could mean my assassination, if she decided I needed it. It is Mother's spies I want you to be concerned with, most of all, but certainly not exclusively. I find myself with an abundance of foes. I'll keep dear Mother at the top of my list, he assured. To be honest, Minolin, I'm starting to like this idea. Ever since the invasion and the loss of the Fairvale, and all of my kin, he added darkly, I think I roamed the dangerous roads into the darkness, half hoping I'd get myself killed in some spectacularly glorious fashion, Janik sighed heavily. Something poetic, if the gods were kind, or at least something meaningful, although I'd be just as happy passing quietly in my sleep, or, better yet, stabbed in the back by a jealous husband, he added, looking around for any passing divinities who might be listening. In case that's a concern to anyone. But I had purpose back then. More purpose than being the last forgotten wastrel's son of a once proud, virtuous, poetically brilliant, musically adept, and terribly humble family of minstrels. I thought the Rish had died with the Fair Vale's destruction. I returned from an exile in darkness, a pauper expecting the cold welcome of a barren wasteland, and instead, I find someone has gone and built a charming little civilization in my absence, one that lords me with praise and riches. Now you employ me in capacities I doubt my sires were ever entrusted with, he said. That's quite a change of circumstances on short acquaintance. And that makes you suspicious, I prodded. I'd be a fool not to be, Janik nodded. During our short acquaintance, I've watched you, as I promised I would. More. I've tried to discover what you are hiding. What am I supposed to be hiding? I asked, curiously. That's what I endeavored to discover. You're a wizard. Of course you're hiding something. Your entire profession is an elaborate exercise in deception and obfuscation, he challenged. You have collectively tried to obscure the nature of your powers and their understanding since the Majocracy. I winced, despite myself. What Janik was saying was an echo of a common argument against the Magi, one that had, indeed, been sounded down the ages by our detractors. The Censorate had used it time and time again against us over the years. It was a vague and inexact accusation, difficult to prove and even more difficult to defend against, largely because it was true. I cleared my throat and launched into the Magi's standard counter to it. "Actually," I began, "it's not so much that we try to keep our powers obscure. It's that the knowledge to properly wield them involves several disciplines that require intense study. As a properly chartered mage, I must know physics, alchemy, natural history, medicine and anatomy, and realms most mundane folk cannot even begin to fathom. From a surgeon's perspective, a wizard's insights on a patient may involve disciplines for which he has not trained. When asked to explain, it's often simpler to just shrug and say, 'It's magic,' even when it's not." "I see your point," Janik said, nodding. "When someone asks me where I get my ideas for songs or verse, instead of strangling them on the spot with my lute strings for daring to ask such a predictable question, I tell them the gods provide," he said with a shrug. "Exactly," I agreed. "Sometimes we can't explain what we're doing because we'd have to explain 30 other things first in order for our explanation to make the slightest sense. In a way, secrets are our stock in trade, not by design, but by the nature of what we do." "Understood. Well, much of what I thought you were hiding, you, in fact, revealed to me by allowing me to witness your deliberations," he said, slapping his hands on his thighs. "That was a revelation. I learned that the sea folk, whom I always considered mythical, were actually our landlords. I learned that the Alka'alon, whom I always considered fable, are finicky neighbours who either hate our very presence or enjoy slumming with the mortals. And I learned that our monarchs are bloodthirsty assassins who don't mind a pile of bodies if a crown is their reward. The three together explain quite a bit of your motivations," he concluded. "But if I didn't know of them, then I'd suspect you were misguided at best, or mad at worst." "I wouldn't abandon either possibility just yet," I said drolly. "We haven't even gotten around to discussing the role the gods are playing in this contest." "The gods?" Janik asked, his eyebrows shooting to the top of his face in surprise. "They're real. As real as you or me," I sighed, "just more self-involved, fixated and woefully unorganized. Patience, my friend, you'll learn more than you'll want to about forces you've always taken for granted." "You do little to allay my anxiety, Minilin," Janik said after a pause, as he poured his glass full. "Here I thought I could seek solace in the divine, if the arcane failed to work." I snorted, pouring my own glass full. It seemed like the proper response. "If only we could, Janik. There is power in the gods. Power perhaps beyond that of even the sea folk, who have ruled Kalador since beyond antiquity. And we are only newly come to this world, in their minds. Yet our divinities can do things they've never experienced. Alas, our gods, at least the ones that have manifested to me personally, are somewhat unsophisticated," I admitted, choosing my words carefully. "Brigham might have a sense of humour, but she was also a goddess of vengeance. And Ishii? I really didn't need to piss her off. I had enough enemies, and I didn't need to include her in their ranks. Ishii plays dirty, and takes offence more easily than most." Janik stared at me, as if he was debating whether or not I was being serious. "Unsophisticated. I wouldn't mention that to the ecclesiastic set. They might take offence." "So would the gods," I grunted. "I'm more concerned about their judgment than the clergy's." "That said," I continued, trying to rally my enthusiasm, "I'm sensitive to the temple's perspectives, for their social position, not their ability to arouse the divine." "A perspective any good sovereign should respect," Janik agreed. "Yet if the gods are so powerful, why cannot they deliver us from our eventual doom? I confess I lose sleep over that question." "What man hasn't?" I offered, knowing the moment I said it how trite it sounded. "I believe the truth is somewhere betwixt our greatest hopes and our darkest fears, which is an entirely unsatisfying conclusion," I said with complete sincerity. "If only someone reasonable was in charge," Janik offered with a chuckle. someone who could keep the gods and the temples in place. If you're looking for a candidate, I must respectfully decline. I have better things to do, I assured him. Minolan, Janik said after a few moments of contemplation, forgive my unsophisticated, rustic perspective, but I really don't think you'll have much choice in the matter, he said sympathetically. I tried to put aside the implications of Janik's discussion and focus on the war, while he went off in search of spies in Vanador. There were preparations that needed my attention, but that didn't mean I escaped those implications. They kept creeping into my mind in my idle moments. In just a few weeks, first Falassa and then Bova had become persistent, thanks to my interference with the Divine Order. That brought the number of gods in my personal pantheon to 9. Despite the impulse to feel inordinately proud of such an achievement, I also feared that my meddling with the natural order could only have profound consequences. I felt like a child playing dangerously close to the edge of a very deep well. Nor could I particularly count on their divine assistance in any meaningful way, at least not so far. While Spellgarden's garden was bursting into verdant brilliance, Bova's contribution to the cause was less apparent. Her blessed herd was thriving in their pen, but that was about it. Indeed, the only cow-oriented activity that I'd heard of since her divine visitation was an increase in the number of beasts who'd broken out of their pastures and gone astray. I knew that the Haywardens, who chased them, often prayed to her for assistance, but I really didn't see how that helped anything, unless she was trying to drum up more worshippers. As for the others, only Sisu seemed to be playing an active role in the war. The tribal god of the hunt continued to pursue goblins and other foul folk around the Wilderlands, though there did not seem to be much strategy to his hunts. There were reports of the big man leading a pack of giant hunting dogs relentlessly through the snows all winter, sometimes accompanied by a band of Wilderfolk, or Kasari, who were honoured with his patronage. Heath, my arcanist, collected them avidly, compiling a colourful study of the persistent god and his hunts. I didn't see much use for such a thing, but that's the sort of work an arcanist performed, I gathered. The accounts are consistent on many points, he explained to me at a brief meeting we had the day before I departed for Iron Hill. Sisu appears as a tall, well-muscled, clean-shaven and bald man of fearsome visage and a piercing hawk-like gaze. He bears a great bow and a quiver on his back, as well as a long hunting spear of magnificent craft, and a horn-bladed hunting knife on his belt. I've met him, I reminded him. He's a bit intimidating. He's relentless, Heath said admiringly. This sacred pack of hunting dogs he's assembled includes the giant Kasari dogs, as well as hounds of every other size and description. Men who have witnessed his hunts, and even participated, report that they are overcome with a kind of frenzy when in his presence. They are able to cover miles and miles on foot without becoming exhausted. The hunting parties are able to track the prey across rivers, gorges, and densest forest as effortlessly as walking across this room. What is he hunting? I asked, curious. Everything, Heath replied, rifling through his notes. Mostly Draugen, lately, around Gajakatar's old fortress. But he's also gone after Gavanni patrols, hobgoblins, a couple of siege worms that escaped into the wild. Those were, reportedly, the wildest and most magnificent hunts, including parties of more than 30 men. I've got half a dozen accounts that talk about the amazing celebration Sisu holds afterwards. His encampment, they all say, is of surpassing elegance and filled with unexpected comforts. And after he departs, many relate that they find their ability to track or to run or to handle their own hounds increases. One man says he can now understand the speech of birds, he added skeptically. It's fascinating. But how is it useful? I frowned. I have no idea, Heath answered with enthusiasm. He's not making war, exactly. He doesn't attack large groups. He hunts. He has prey. While there is likely a boost in morale resulting from word of his magnificent hunts, sadly, I doubt there is much strategic value. Yet he must have some method for selecting his prey, I nodded, as I combed through the accounts myself. Why cannot he develop an interest in the Nemovorti, for instance, or dragons? He does have an antipathy toward wyverns, both large and small, Heath pointed out. There are several instances of him drawing his bow and plucking them out of the air without halting in pursuit of other prey. He probably sees them as pests, not prey, I surmised. I know little about him, but he supposedly disdains the use of poisons in the hunt. It's not sporting, and wyverns use toxic secretions in their hunting, so it could be a religious thing. Well, he's growing a respectable cult among the Kasari and some Wilderlords, Heath acknowledged. I was aware of that. I'd seen some wearing wooden or metal talismans in the shape of a hunting horn around Vanador. Those who have participated with Sisu's hunt are starting to serve as a kind of lay order, Heath continued. They are treated with respect, and their stories are often sought out by the curious. But there is no liturgy or clergy evolving, just an increasing body of mythological lore. Well, he was originally a tribal god, I nodded. They tend more toward shamanic rites than clericalism. I'm actually thankful for that. I don't need any more clergy to complicate things, I said, and then related Janik's efforts at Honeyhall with the hermits of Cornerville. Heath hurriedly scribbled down the details while I spoke, as he was wont to do when new information came to him. He looked up from the page as I finished. That's interesting, he agreed thoughtfully. I'm just an arcanist, but I'm seeing a conflation of mystical forces brewing here in the Mage Lore, Minolan. There are common elements amongst the cult of Sisu, the hermits, and the priesthood of Falasa, among others. Apparently, there was an underground cult that arose in Verone a few years ago, led by the Master of the Wood, some sort of shadowy underground Wilderlands figure. Oh, that was Pentandra, I supplied, or at least it was her idea. Part of her infiltration against the Brotherhood of the Rat. Oh, that's a pity, he frowned, but intriguing in its own right, he said, making a note. But it doesn't necessarily detract from my hypothesis. Which is? I asked, curious as to what my expert on minutiae had in mind. Perhaps an expression of a novel mystical element appearing? He ventured, after a moment's thought. I'm no theurge, but even I can see that having the gods wandering around all the time is going to have an effect. I just can't possibly predict how it will be manifested. It's going to be a surprise, he guessed, unhelpfully. Well, it keeps things interesting, I said with a heavy sigh, as there was a knock at the door. Heath rarely brought me answers that didn't spawn a blizzard of more questions, I noted to myself as he rose to answer it. It proved to be the slim, black-cloaked, white-haired figure of Atopol, the Black Cat of Night, or something like that. Ah, the thief I ordered has arrived, I smiled, pleased to be able to set aside the disturbing possibilities of the divine in favour of the simpler matter of war. Come in, gentlemen. Atopol, this is Heath the Arcanist. Heath, this is Atopol, the second best thief in an Ultramar. Have a seat. I want to discuss a few details to my battle plan. Sandoval had been inspecting Iron Hill, much to Iron Peg's dismay. She'd rebuffed attempts by officials of lesser rank, but as the constable of the count, Sandy had sufficient rank to force the issue. She couldn't very well turn away my direct subordinate on official business. That didn't mean she was happy about it. The old Wilderlord didn't appreciate too much scrutiny from her feudal overlords, and she was positively appalled that Sandy had included non-humans in his inspection detail. Sandy had merely brought along a few Dradrian to help with the inspection, including reviewing her mining operation. Among them was Master Suhi's nephew, Agarth. While Sandy was evaluating the walls and provisions of the squat little fortress, the Dradrian were crawling through her tunnels. Her brother accompanied them and proved just as obstinate as his sister, especially when the Dradrian dared criticize their operation. That's when Agarth's special nose caught a whiff of something strange, and he tried to follow it. The Dradrian miner had a special talent, possibly magical in nature, for detecting metal by smell. It made him an invaluable prospector when searching for the purest ores. But it wasn't iron that got Agarth's mighty nostrils twitching, nor even gold. It was aluminum, and titanium, and other more exotic metals. That's also when Iron Peg's pig-headed brother went from being merely obstinate to belligerent. He tried to keep the Draudrian from descending the tunnel that led to the intriguing aroma with a number of poor excuses, and then interposed himself when Agarth got insistent. That didn't go well. An argument ensued, and Sandy and Iron Peg were sent for. And that's when Sandy had to pull rank and order the exploration upon pain of declaring the domain in rebellion. From what I understand, it became heated until Sandy calmly suggested arresting the entire family and having them hauled to a dungeon in Vanador if they didn't yield to the search. Reluctantly, Iron Peg and her men stood down and allowed the Draudrian to lead Sandy and a few of his men down the tunnel until it came out into the secret cavern Janik had described. It was, indeed, as spectacularly appointed as he'd suggested, a real hidden castle capable of sustaining a small force for months underground. The far exit was carefully concealed a sufficient distance from the castle to behave as a postern, allowing the Iron Hill folk to harass any besieging force from behind or steal away from a siege entirely. But that wasn't why Sandy called me in. He'd known about the cavern refuge because I'd told him. He just used the Draudrian as his excuse to protect Janik from blame. He expected to find something of the sort. What he hadn't anticipated was that the Iron Hill folk were not the first to use the place. I came through the ways to Sandy's waystone, deep underground, with Ruderal as my aid for the day. Sandy had the place strewn with mage lights, which cast a multitude of shadows. Larger than the great hall of Iron Hill's keep, the underground chamber was, indeed, stuffed with bales, boxes, baskets, and sacks. It looked like any storeroom prepared for siege, though the scale was larger than most. "It looks pretty typical to me," I observed after I greeted Sandy. "Salt port, prosago root, hardtack, dried fruit, grain, fuel, wine. Enough to last a while." "Some of it has been used and replaced recently, too," he pointed out as he led me around the pile of supplies. "That's how her people survived the invasion and the aftermath. A well-hardened castle sitting atop a cave full of provisions. But that's not why I summoned you," he continued. "Agarth's nose caught a whiff of something odd, and when he followed it, it led him back here," he explained, as he summoned another mage light to hover overhead. "When I saw this, I thought you would want to look through it." His light revealed, squeezed into a small chamber, near to what I assumed was the escape tunnel to the surface, containing a collection of what I instantly recognized as Tekka. Instead of being in a chaotic heap, like most of my collection was, these artifacts were neatly assembled and arrayed for use. Iron Peg's ancestors hadn't touched them, it appeared. To their eyes, the inert specimens of strangely designed metal were potentially dangerous. As they were not in the way, and many were too large to move without disassembly, they had simply ignored the trove of ancient Tekka. But I was fascinated. I waved my hand to push a magical force over the widest surface, a broad metallic case with two parallel red bands down one side, and once the dust was gone, I could read the neatly inscribed words in old High Perwanese. "Terra Formation Monitoring Station 117, Western Reserve Region," I read aloud. I'm sure my pronunciation was crap, but I knew the words.
"You know what that is?"
Sandy asked, surprised.
"A bit,"
I admitted as I studied the rest of the casing. When our ancestors were given leave to settle here, they endeavored to make Kalador more like their home, I lectured. That's what the term terraformation meant. They used their Tekka and skyships and all manner of alchemy to prepare the soil and then plant beneficial Impotasta species, starting in Perwin, but eventually all over the five duchies, I explained.
"I understand that part," Sandy said patiently. "I was wondering if you knew what this particular thing does."
"As I said, a bit," I continued, as I circled the piece. It was about the size of a small boat, mostly rectangular,
although there were plenty of oddly shaped parts and pieces to it. Once the soil and plants and animals were introduced, their numbers and habits were studied to determine the failure or success of a particular species. These examinations were done with monitoring stations, of which this is one. "Forseti is going to be excited by this," agreed Ruderal, looking upon the Tekka with undisguised fascination. "He spoke of such stations and encouraged our search for them." "Forseti?" Sandy asked, confused. "An ancient intelligence from that time," I explained. "One of the bits of Tekka I picked up over the years. A memory of our revered ancestors, brought back to a kind of functioning after centuries. Though diminished, it has survived sufficiently intact to provide some useful information," I informed him. "I keep him at a secret cave in one of my estates," I said, being vague on purpose, just to frustrate him.
"Does everyone have a secret cave?"
Sandy demanded, looking around the cavern skeptically.
"Why did no one tell me?"
"It's become fashionable amongst a certain social set," I agreed. "You should consider getting one, particularly now that you're married." Sandoval frowned.
"Min, I appreciate you screwing around with the ancient past and unknown enchantments and the laws of reality and such, but you really need to be careful about that old stuff," he said worriedly. "You remember what problems those things caused from the magocracy?
Relax. This one is far tamer than the staff of the Archmage," I promised, "and far less potent. Indeed, Forseti was involved with the terraformation effort, and was lost long before the magocracy rose. Currently, it's a disembodied voice who has been marginally useful in answering some of my more obscure questions. Perhaps Heath can get more out of it," I considered. "He's an arcanist. He enjoys the obscure."
"Forseti is seeking to improve his condition," Ruderal added enthusiastically, "particularly his power." "It was power that the staff of the Archmage sought," reminded Sandy grimly.
"Different kind of power," Ruderal said, shaking his head. "Electrical power, in very specific ways. Just blasting it with lightning won't work." "I asked," the boy added. "Right now, Forseti is surviving on an extremely limited amount supplied from daylight." He used the metaphor that it's like having a big empty belly and a very small mouth. "But it's possible," my apprentice said, examining the equipment in the cave closely, "that some of these components can be used to augment his abilities. Give him a bigger mouth."
"And perhaps feet," I said, as I moved over to one of the other pieces in the chamber. "About as big as a wheelbarrow. It was a longer rectangle with an even greater array of unusual projections and protrusions. Like the larger machine, it too had the two parallel red bands painted around its circumference. Unlike the larger, it wasn't mounted to the floor, but stood on six odd-looking wheels."
"This is some sort of mobile device," I decided. "The terraformers used passive sensors to monitor the land, it is said, but they also used engines such as this to travel the land, counting birds and squirrels or something."
"Do you think Forseti could use it as a cart, Master?" Ruderal asked curiously. "Because a dangerous intelligence is somehow more comforting when it's mobile?" Sandy asked sarcastically.
"We can only investigate the matter," I nodded, "but I'm hopeful."
"Really, Sandy, Forseti wouldn't harm anyone. It's dedicated to the success of the colony, which means our success," I argued.
"As frightening as this ancient, immobile little cart might seem to you," I teased, "I think we have the resources to defend ourselves."
"I'm not an ignorant peasant man," Sandy replied evenly. "I know what these things are, in the abstract," he admitted. "They're merely tools. Really sophisticated, sometimes dangerous, occasionally deadly tools that we know little or nothing about. I read a lot of magocracy-era literature when I was in school," he explained. "Almost all of those fables have the Tekka doing something disastrous or hilarious, or both, like the tale of the horse and the scooter, or the wain with the metal wheels. And there are plenty of purely historical accounts about how our ancestors' toys turned against them."
"You're being paranoid," I pointed out, a little critically. "But you aren't wrong. Some of these things can be dangerous. That's actually what I'm hoping for." Would it soothe your superstitious peasant imagination if I had Lelastian take a look at it first? She was on Perwin during the colonization. She'd know what this stuff is better than anyone, and perhaps understand what it does. Ah, let the immortal Alka Alon sorceress mess around with ancient artifacts her people didn't build, he snorted. We let Dunsellan mess around with Irionite, I countered, and see how that turned out. Go ahead, Min, he sighed. You're the spellmonger. This is the kind of crazy wizard stuff that you do. I'm merely a normal war mage and thaumaturge, he reasoned, folding his arms. And yes, I am paranoid. It makes me good at what I do. I know, I agreed, but in this case, we're going to take a few risks. We have to, for reasons that are too complicated to go into and too controversial to defend. It's spellmonger stuff, I summarized. Of course it is. Fine. But what do I tell Iron Peg? He asked, clearly irritated. I straightened from examining the little cart. Tell her that the Count of the Mage Law is confiscating this stuff and declaring this cavern a strategic county resource for the coming war. If she objects, I can confiscate the entire cavern and deny her its use. If she still objects, I can remove her from her domain, I pronounced. That should be persuasive enough, Sandy agreed. Iron Peg was actually quite willing to part with the ancient junk in the corner. It had no value to her, since it was not iron and couldn't be sold at Veron. She was much less enthusiastic about letting outsiders know about her hidey hole, much less use it. It's just too strategically valuable, Sandy argued as we concluded the negotiations. We can conceal two companies of infantry here. There's even a stable of sorts, and a portion of the tunnel large enough to conceal a few squadrons of cavalry. That element of surprise could turn the tide of the invasion, he persuaded. It's my family's legacy to keep this place sacred, Peg declared, her pipe clutched between her defiant lips. It has sheltered my line for generations, and it shall continue to do so, I agreed, as long as your line holds these lands. But such a secret is of little use if it is not exploited in a timely manner, Lady Pegala. Kept to yourself, this cave would allow you to survive the war. Used to effect, this cave allows me to win the war. I hope you can appreciate the distinction, and the implicit threat to your rule, I added conversationally.
Aye, you're my liege lord, she said with reluctant bitterness, ruled by a fool wizard. What's the Wilderlands coming to? But I swore my oath. I'll do my duty. Take that ironmongery if you wish. We can use the space. Use the cave, and let not one man more than you need know about it. But I command my castle, she insisted. Iron Hill is mine to command.
Agreed, I nodded. But I will insist on putting a war mage or two here to coordinate your defence with the other castles.
More fool wizards. A bloody waste, if you ask me, she grumbled, shaking her head.
I persuaded Lelastian to pause her oversight of the new hospital and inspect the equipment in the cave, as much to properly identify it as to mollify Sandy's concerns. It didn't take her long. After a few moments of examining the pieces, and a few pregnant pauses as she recalled information she had learned dozens of human lifetimes ago, she reported to me with a grin.
Yes, it's a simple monitoring station, she assured. Late stage in the terraformation process, I'd say. It was designed to evaluate the health of microorganisms, atmospheric gases, radiation, biological markers, a score of factors that the terraformers watched to see how well the biome graft was taking. These little rovers, she said, indicating the overachieving wheelbarrow, would go out periodically, sniff the air, dig in the dirt, and count insects, plants, and animals.
Does it still work? I asked curiously.
Oh, goodness, no,
Lelastian said, shaking her head with a giggle. Their power sources were only designed to last a decade or so. When they ran down and no one came by to recharge them, they would have stopped working. My shoulders sagged. So this won't be of use to Forseti, I sighed.
What? No, Min, this is an invaluable find. This equipment is almost pristine.
Oh, the rover has a bit of wear, but it's still completely intact. In fact, it has an independent rechargeable power supply, as well as a solar array, since it requires a lot of energy to move around and conduct sampling. When it stopped receiving instruction from the base unit, it went into a dormant mode to conserve what it had. She knelt to caress the thing like a dog, but exposed an interior panel instead. "Don't break it," I urged, as she snapped open a metal cover. She ignored me, and I felt a little foolish. Of course, the Lastian knew what she was doing. "Actually, this little one has almost 22% power left. That's remarkable, considering its age. And if I recall, these little fellows had a full array of... Yes! See this long tube here? That's a boom arm. It can produce a solar array similar to the one Forseti is using now, only larger and a lot more efficient. I doubt it could charge the rover back to full power on its own, but it's easily 3 or 4 times more efficient than what we're using now," she declared confidently. "Well, that will extend the time we get to speak with him," I conceded. "It will do more than that," she assured, as she poked at the panel. "This fitting here is an override cradle. Ordinarily, this little thing operates from instructions from the base unit, and doesn't need much more sense than a mule to conduct its missions. But if a more nuanced mission required a stronger intelligence, a smarter machine could be grafted onto the chassis. One like Forseti. That would allow it to use the unit's sensors, operate its motors and wheels, and most importantly, use the internal communication devices." "Why is that the most important?" I asked, curious. "Because it will allow Forseti to speak with other bits of Tekka, and in some cases command them." "You seem to put a lot of faith into this disembodied voice," Sandy remarked, frowning. "Forseti is a simple machine, compared to some of the devices your ancestors built," the Lastian explained. "They graded their mechanical servants in 5 levels of intelligence. The first level were devices even simpler than this rover. This fellow has a level 2, she said, patting the machine affectionately. "Simple decision-making, about as smart as a dog or a horse. Forseti is a level 3, with some interesting augmentations, about as smart as a human or Karshak. Level 4s tended to conduct large, intricate operations, like scientific endeavors or large-scale projects. Level 5s were the most specialized and did things like running entire cities or scientific installations, directing colonial policy or commanding spaceships. They were almost as smart as an Alka Alon. Most of the serious problems arising in the later colonial period were the fault of the level 5s, she finished. "What level was the staff of the Archmage?" I asked, suddenly very curious. "That was a particularly egotistical level 5, Lelastian frowned, her face immediately troubled. "The ones who are almost as smart as Alka Alon," Sandy reminded her. "Why, yes," the Sorceress of Sartha Wood agreed, appreciating his sarcasm. "In fact, the intelligence of the staff of the Archmage was one of the central planning intelligences for the colony. It was once in charge of all of Leiden City on Perwin, and was one of the few to escape the unpleasantness before the inundation. While instrumental in reforming the government, it was also ruthless in its administration, and that caused problems," she conceded solemnly. "But that's ancient history. I'm more concerned with current events. Allowing Forseti to utilize this rover and the components in the base station will not be the start of some cataclysm, and it might actually be helpful," she pointed out. "Besides, we resurrect ancient horrors from millions of years ago to imbue our thaumaturgical constructs with a semblance of intelligence," I reasoned to Sandy. "Bringing one of our ancestor servants back into its rightful service surely can't be more dangerous than that." "You're the spellmonger," he shrugged. "If you see a need for this, of course I approve. As long as you understand that I reserve the right to destroy it, if it goes mad and tries to kill us all," Sandy insisted. I was startled. His tone was virtually identical to Iron Peg's concession to explore the cave. "That's why I keep you around,"
I agreed. Transferring most of the equipment back to the cave at Spellgarden was easy enough with a Hoxter pocket, and it had the added benefit of instantly freeing up enough room to board even more horses in the cave. I left Sandy to his logistics and planning and returned to my estate, where I detailed Ruderal and Gareth to improve Forseti's lot as well as they could. As eager as I was to see the result, other matters became more pressing almost as soon as I returned to Vanador. I had a trio of spies to interrogate. The entire affair had arisen while I was at Iron Hill, and had resolved itself before I returned. It seems that an enterprising drunkard in Vanador had noted the arrival of three Gilmoran knights, doing their best to disguise themselves as Wilberlords, conspiring in a tavern near the city's nascent gates. Alarmed at what he overheard from three so blatantly disguised individuals, he enlisted the attention of Fundaris, the head of my field wizards, with whom he was acquainted. The old foot wizard did a neat job of surveilling the men, himself, with magic and in person. When he was convinced of their intentions, he alerted Gareth's office, who sent over a squadron of city watchmen to arrest the Gilmoran gentlemen. It seems they were conspiring to kidnap, or rescue, depending upon your perspective, Lady Matherian from her captivity. They confessed almost at once, in the presence of a law brother and under the influence of a truth-tell spell. They were vassals of Count Anverham, and they were tasked to both spy upon the mage law in preparation for a future campaign, as well as to find and secure the sequestered bride by any means within their power. Thankfully, the three had been spooked by the casual magics replete in Vanador and were genuinely inept at espionage. But now I had Sir Holwyn, Sir Lenameth, and Sire Grenard to contend with and render justice upon. The facts of the case were established before I ever saw the gentleman. Under direction of Count Anverham's Master of Horse, Sire Molinar, by way of a shadow intermediary known as Sir Halkett, the three loyal knights had been tasked to infiltrate the Mage Law, determine the location of Lady Matherian, rescue her if possible, and along the way take notes on our defences that might be of help in a future military invasion. As spies go, the trio was as inept as they were eager to conduct such a daring mission in loyal service to their liege. All three were scions of proud, if minor, noble houses of Gilmora, who also happened to lie firmly in the pro-Castoli political camp. They saw themselves as agents of good, struggling against the conceits and conspiracies of an evil wizard, and one who held their very stations in open disdain. But they were woefully out of their element the moment their journey took them beyond Verone. Wilderlords were strange enough to the knights. Mage lords and the marvels they commanded were entirely novel. Seeing a few old mage lights pop up in Barrowbell during a tournament is one thing, witnessing the wonders of Castle Megalyn from a distance, or seeing the vast complex of Spellgate, or encountering the many magical curiosities of Vanador, had seen the simple knights quite out of their element. Nor had they given proper care to concealing their speech. They spoke openly of their mission in public, even when they were being overheard, without recourse to code words or even simple discretion. I credited that mistake more to their cultural arrogance than to stupidity. The Gilmorans legitimately did not consider the Wilderfolk and the Mage Lords intelligent enough to see beyond their simple disguises. The former were simple bumpkins, in the eyes of Gilmoran society, and the latter were too scheming and mad for power to notice. Nor did they appear to have been instructed in the most basic arts of espionage, or even simple discretion in the slightest degree. They had been chosen, I realized, on the basis of their youth, their pedigrees, and their expendability. They ranged from terrified to glum, as I regarded them in the city watchroom. Law Brother Bright accompanied me upon my invitation, and Gareth insisted on being there in his capacity as Pentandra's steward. But I could tell the lad took the presence of spies in his land personally. "What do you know of Count Anverham's plans to invade the Mage Law?" Gareth demanded of the men, unartfully. "We will never betray our liege, Mageling," spat the oldest of the three, Sire Grenard. "You already have, gentlemen," I interrupted, before Gareth could tarnish the interrogation. "Your very presence betrays his intentions.
By your confessions, you are engaged in military espionage on behalf of a hostile power. The Mage Law sees that as a capital offence, I observed coolly. With a word, I can see you three hung within the hour for what you have admitted. You heard lies, lies compelled by magic, insisted Holwyn nervously. He was terribly uncomfortable with his hands bound behind his back. The truth-tell's spells were administered by a sworn officer of the court, with no experience of the matter, until he was summoned, Gareth informed him, in the presence of a law brother, all perfectly legal and utterly trustworthy. But that would only be of issue if this was a civil matter, I added. Your employment by Count Anvaram is a hostile act against my realm, which is a military matter. I have complete discretion under the law in this instance. But the truth will suffice. Your lord conspires to make war upon me, I pronounced. He seeks to rescue a maiden cruelly held against her will, Lenormeth objected anxiously. And punish the dishonour which you have given to Gilmoran chivalry, added Holwyn. Which is an act of war, I agreed patiently. Well, I did invite him to try to find Vanador. I suppose this is what passes as his first try. Do I need to put you three back under a truth-tell spell? Or can I rely on your candour? I asked sharply. Do be sincere. Your necks depend upon it. We'll tell you what we know, admitted Lenormeth sulkily. Sir, hold to your oath, Granard demanded of his friend angrily. It's our necks, hissed Holwyn. We're no use to the Count if we're dead. There is no dishonour in being fairly bested, gentlemen, I observed coolly. You tried to spy on a mage lord. You were caught. It is easy enough to compel your testimony by spell or torture, but I'm a reasonable man who appreciates reasonable men. Speak freely, and you may well spare your lives and a great deal of discomfort. Count Anvaram gathers his banners in preparation to ride north, as soon as the roads are clear, Lenormeth admitted. He convenes a large host of his vassals and a few mercenaries at his seat. Our expedition was to establish the route and scout it thoroughly, as well as discover what we could about Lady Methyrian. How large a force? Demanded Gareth. At least 1,000 lances, Holwyn bragged, and several thousand mercenaries. A lance was 5 men. That meant 5,000 to 8,000 in Anvaram's party. A formidable force, to be sure. When will he depart? Gareth continued. I couldn't fault the lad's determination, but I had what I needed from these men. Further interrogation would be pointless. But that didn't mean that the trio wasn't useful to me. He will depart 2 weeks after he thinks he will, and will struggle mightily along the way, I predicted. He will leave his lands full of enthusiasm, but soon find his every attempt to advance a challenge. You see the future? Asked Holwyn skeptically. No, I've just been a part of several military expeditions, and that's how they all happen, I countered. Count Anvaram is no field general. This will be his first attempt at commanding such a large host for a prolonged period. As good as his advisers are, and as thorough as his support no doubt is, he will find the task frustrating long before he ever reaches a battlefield. If he makes haste, he risks spreading out his force and losing it to desertion and opportunistic raids. If he is cautious, he will lose any surprise he might have and risk his men to disease and starvation. That many horses requires a lot of silage, I pointed out. You imply that this endeavour is blessed by greater forces, my lord? Brother Bright asked, surprised. Let's ask, I shrugged. Who is funding Anvaram's folly, my lords? I asked politely. Our liege is a man of great wealth, bragged Granard defiantly. Not so great as to fund an expedition that takes the bulk of his nobility on holiday for an entire growing season, pointed out Gareth as he started to understand. I suspect Prince Tavard's influence in this, sire, Gareth murmured to me. It would be illegal for a liege to fund a war on a fellow vassal in such a way, Brother Bright frowned. To pay money to a vassal to make war on a rival is strictly prohibited by the laws of Duin and Luin. I doubt it was an explicit payment, I pointed out. Anvaram's honour would not let him act as a base mercenary, not for mere coin, even for his liege. I think other means were found. It is well known that the Count receives gifts of honour from Prince Tavard, Holwyn ventured. At Yule he was granted 6 large estates, and a massive golden statue of a hound by the prince. Gold, not gilt, he insisted. That would get around the matter of an exchange of coin, Brother Bright conceded. Anverham probably sold it at once, or had it melted down to pay for the expedition. Of such deceits the nobility thrives in their corruption, condemned the law brother. It allows the prince to plausibly deny any involvement, I pointed out. Anverham, alone, bears the responsibility for the expedition. But I'm certain that there was a secret agreement, I said confidently. Anverham is the most likely tool for Tavard's wrath. Was exile not enough punishment? Gareth asked. This is about more than mere revenge, Brother Bright suggested. There are great powers at play. Since the establishment of the Curia of the Counts to fund the kingdom, the centre of power has shifted away from the dukes. Prince Tavard seeks to strike a political foe by proxy and consolidate his power base. I suppose Tavard should be upset at the poor quality of spies his gold paid for, Gareth said, gesturing toward the 3 bound Kilmorans. Oh, I don't know. If this was a regular feudal war, these 3 would be adequate, no doubt, I chuckled. They might have even been successful. But your point is well taken, Gareth. They are poorly equipped for this particular war. Which war is that, my lord? Brother Bright asked pointedly. Do we not face a much more fearsome foe in Shacathet than Emmervort, than in Count Anverham the Cuckold? It's all one war, I countered. You just have to see it in the right way. Very well. These 3 gentlemen shall be imprisoned in Anguin's Tower until such time as I take up their disposition. You will place us in some foul wizard's den, snarled Granard defiantly. It's actually quite lovely, Gareth demurred, but I have a feeling you'll not see much more than the stables, if I know the keeper of the tower, he suggested. As knights, I assume you're well acquainted with the husbandry of horses. Do we really need a second enemy, my lord? Brother Bright asked sceptically, as the 3 knights were being led away. You just have to look at the situation properly, I shrugged. Tavard was going to come after me, as you pointed out. He needs to break up my alliance with Anguin, and sees this as the most direct way to challenge that. It's poorly conceived and doomed to failure, but it was the reasonable choice for him to make, under the circumstances. That doesn't seem to bother you, the Lord Brother observed. Minolan accumulates enemies like a poor man does creditors, or a pretty girl does suitors, Gareth snorted. Tavard is merely the most high-born of them. But you are strangely undisturbed by the prospect of facing 5 or 6,000 angry Gilmoran knights. I find that intriguing. Compared to 50,000 screaming of Annie, they're an afterthought, I dismissed. I don't fear Anverham's fury, or his competence, if these 3 are any indication. We'll see if they make it as far as Verone. I do find these displays of irrational confidence encouraging, Brother Bright declared. It's a brilliant distraction from the prospect of certain death. You need to trust Minolan, Gareth suggested. He may not know what he's doing, but he fakes it convincingly. He gets results, he insisted to the monk. Oh, I'm aware. Brother Bright nodded with a sigh. I just wish he was less messy in how he does it. Chapter 14. A Goddess in My Bedchamber. Hail the bearer of burdens, strong beyond measure. Hail the milk mother, provider of nourishment. Hail the goddess of the kine, her hooves and horns bless us. Hail Bova, hail the goddess of cows, moo, moo, moo. Traditional hymn to Bova, goddess of the kine, from the collection of Janik the Rish. There was a decided uneasiness that bloomed across the penumbra that spring, along with the wild flowers and the new green shoots and fresh leaves. As promising as the vernal season was by its nature, even those settlements isolated enough to hear little about the greater world felt the coming battles in the air, like warm breezes. There were few enough of them. Scattered across the expanse of the western bank of the Wildwater Vales, the rolling terrain of the Penumbra concealed scores of hamlets and freeholds that had somehow escaped both the brutal onslaught of the initial invasion and its long, lingering aftermath. Those strongholds that had persisted hadn't done so unaided, however. For many years, the lonely Iron Band's men had been the only force keeping the Gavanni at bay. The Iron Band had been one of King Rard's initial concessions to the threat of the Gavanni. The conscripted order was comprised of debtors who sought to have their debts absorbed by the crown in return for 7 years' service in the Penumbra. Their string of fortresses that stretched from Ospery to Verone were known collectively as the Iron Ring, taken from Rard's inaugural speech as king. As bold as the name was, the Iron Ring was a tepid response to the threat of the Gavanni. The unit was perpetually underfunded, poorly armed and poorly provisioned. Despite the annual payments from the Royal Treasury for its upkeep, the institutional resources of the Iron Band had always been thin. Now they were threadbare. The Iron Band had been recently replenished after an influx of rebellious Alshari noblemen who preferred exile to execution. They weren't the most enthusiastic of recruits, but as many of them had families in the south they wanted to see again, they were as loyal to the order as could be expected. Service in a foreign land against an intractable foe with crappy equipment and virtually no training will do that for you. I'd always tried to support the Iron Band. They weren't glamorous, like the Knights of Megalin or the Astazi Order, but they were dutiful and dedicated. They also tended to be horrible gamblers, which was always popular. They did tremendous work with little resources under trying circumstances. I'd spoken to the Order's leadership at length, in confidence, over the years. Most of their recruits never made it beyond the halfway point in their 7 year service before they fell while on duty. As military outfits went, they were slightly better than the average garrison unit and far below the combat units with whom I was familiar. Some of them had true military talent, as well as training from their old lives. Most were clueless noblemen, with little real experience with a sword until they arrived in the Wilderlands and went on their first patrol. They learned fast, or they got buried at one of many chapel graveyards at glamorous Iron Ring fortresses. The unique nature of the Corps shaped its growth as an institution. Those bandsmen who managed to survive the harsh conditions were afforded great honour and position in the Order, and that increased their dedication to the mission. Those were the ones who treated their oath with seriousness. Those who did not were prone to accidents or incidents on their patrols. Those who performed faithfully were rewarded with advancement and praise. That led to each outpost commander and garrison marshal along the Iron Ring becoming nearly fanatical in their devotion to their charge. For what they were, the Iron Band was surprisingly effective. They had escorted trade caravans and rescued escaped slaves from the Penumbra for more than 5 years now, and provided a decided line of defence against the Gavanni. But that success had been largely because they were unchallenged, though the band had enjoyed more action than most. Since their establishment, they had rarely faced a concerted threat against one of their compounds. Shakathet was going to bring that impressive record to an end, alas. We were fairly certain, after Mavone's careful intelligence gathering, that Fort Destiny, the headquarters of the Iron Band and one of Bendenal's flanking fortresses, was going to be among the first of our citadels to be challenged by Shakathet's legions. By its very nature, Fort Destiny was on the forefront of our defences. It had been established purposefully inside the zone of the enemy's influence. The entire purpose of the garrison was to challenge the idea that humanity had abandoned those lands. For years, the regions around the old hill fort had been held by the Gavanni, or left wild, attracting bandits and refugees, escaped slaves and deserters. Fort Destiny, once known as Castle Dardafan, had been a force for order since the early days. Indeed, it was the very first of the fortresses and outposts garrisoned by the Iron Band. Beginning as a recaptured ruin manned by a skeleton staff, Fort Destiny had grown to hold a garrison of 1,000 men-at-arms, and the surrounding lands were now pacified and somewhat settled. There were tiny hamlets and farmsteads now, within the sight of its towers. The old castle and its impressed garrison provided elusive security in this chaotic and dangerous land. The captain of the band ruled the fortress and the surrounding lands like a normal lord, and the caravans that ran between the far-flung outposts of the band across the entire Iron Ring brought supplies and trade to places where only strife and bloodshed had reigned before. Yet its forward-projecting position made it an irresistible target for Shacketh's generals. The castle could not be ignored during an advance, as it would spew raiders to harass its passage and challenge its supply line. It was just too large, the first of several difficult obstacles to the Nemovort's advance. None of my advisers saw a way for Shacketh to go around the Iron Band headquarters without inviting attack. The famous commander of the corps, Sir Sastan of Pressan, made that all but certain. While his troops were not designed to prevail in open battle, the Iron Band had tenaciously clung on to their precious outposts during the very worst of hostilities. They'd paid a terrible price for doing so. One man in three who took service with the band were slain before their 7-year term expired. Those who survived were adept at guarding caravans, garrisoning outposts, and fighting the brutal bush war that was daily life in the penumbra. Nor did the Iron Band's men shy away from a fight. They were not the enthusiastic warriors of the Megalini Knights, or the War Magi who had built Vanador, or even the dour Al-Shari Third Commandos. They were practical men serving out sentences because they had to, and they were fighting to live because they had no other choice. That said, the chance to cross swords with the foe who had harassed them nightly was something each of them seemed eager for. The problem was, there was little hope that Fort Destiny, for all its tradition and importance, could withstand a direct and concerted assault by Shacketh's forces. We could have devoted a tremendous amount of resources to stiffen its defense. Sandoval sent some trusted men to investigate just that possibility. But the castle was originally built to ward against neighboring wilderlords, not legions upon legions of Gavani, animated by the hatred of their fell masters. The walls of the fortress were proof against cavalry charges by wilderland knights. They were not prepared for siege worms and trolls. The sheer size of Shacketh's army could overwhelm Fort Destiny. From Telemann's perspective, that was a benefit, not a liability. He said as much at one of our impromptu strategy sessions at Spellgarden. It was a controversial decision. Shacketh has to lay siege to the place, no matter what, he argued over wine that evening. Even with his magical bridge, there are limited passages his army can take to get into our interior. All of them put his flanks in danger of raids from Fort Destiny. So we evacuate the fortress and redistribute the troops to better defendable positions, insisted Sandy. Those men would have a better chance fighting at Megalin, which is prepared for such a siege, than defending a doomed castle. Which would cede the route to Shacketh, Tell countered, allowing him entry into our lands unopposed. Not to mention capturing a strong point from us he can use as a depot or position of retreat, he continued, as he cast a mage map into the air between us. That's giving him an unearned advantage that we can ill afford. So what does condemning a few thousand men to a brutal death buy us? Sandy riposted. We know where the enemy will be, Tal said, triumphantly. Yes, completely surrounding our men, Sandy replied dryly. How convenient for us. If we want the opportunity to deploy powerful spells against the massed might of our foes, Tal patiently explained, Fort Destiny gives us the greatest opportunity, when they are freshest, and where they will be tightly massed. You have a spell in mind? I asked, curious. Several, Tal admitted, but that's not the point. We know where the battlefield will be, if we allow them to approach unchallenged and besiege the place. Just like we did with Tudri, Sandy reminded him. We let them walk in, settle down, and then suckered them in with a few cheap spells before we toasted them. I think they might be wary against that sort of thing again, he predicted. This won't be like Tudri, Tal argued. The goal there was to entrap the army within the town. The goal here will be to befoul the army with as many spells as possible before splitting it into parts that are easier for our forces to manage. At Fort Destiny, we can begin the process of grinding Shakathet's great armies into dust.
You'd better think of something damned impressive, then, Sandy sighed. Something along the lines of that millstone of yours.
I've got some ideas, he shrugged. So does Winnick. A lot of people have ideas. Give me a few days and I'll have something more definite. But we have never lacked the capacity to cause great harm. Fort Destiny and its men allow us the opportunity to use it against their gathered might. I don't aim to waste it. For the Iron Band's part, they were eager to fortify their headquarters ahead of the battle. At least the leadership was. The wave of recruits resulting from Anguin's restoration were more sullen about their opportunity for a glorious death. Rebellion, apparently, is easier to raise than a determined defense for those Al-Shaari noblemen. Though technically volunteers, they had the look of conscripts as they drilled, dug, and stocked the keep with essentials. Fighting under the command and for the coin of a king they did not consider legitimate was particularly galling. Fighting under the command of wizards somehow made it worse. The Iron Band actually had a small magical corps, a handful of wizard bandsmen whose fortunes had brought them to the debtor's battalion. I'd quietly granted three of the war magi witchstones over the course of our acquaintance, and all three were gathered to defend the fortress, along with Turleman's team of defensive war magi. There was a limit to how many additional sparks we could add to the defense. The castle was only so large, and a great number of the men had to be infantry. Nearly all the cavalry was withdrawn, save a few patrolling riders. Horses weren't very useful in a siege. Thankfully, enough of the new recruits from an ultramar had been practicing knights that the horsemen who rode for the Iron Band tended to be of good quality, though lightly blooded. Southern Al-Shaar doesn't have the same great chivalric tradition that the Wilderlands had, but those men of the Upper Vale, especially, were well trained in horsemanship and war. 300 knights who wore the Iron Band were placed under Azar's command, much to their distaste. As my master of horse, he would command the mounted forces for the war. In general, I was pleased with how rapidly and professionally things were coming along. Ordinarily, it took far longer for feudal armies to be assembled, trained, and deployed, one of the reasons the goblins had been so successful in the initial invasion. But my Vanadori, and the other domains of the Mage Lore, had accomplished more with magic and good leadership than many dukes could boast. Long before Shakathet's armies would march, our positions had been fortified. Once the spring flooding had subsided, the rivers would be passable, and our foe would advance. Spring tested our ingenuity, forcing us to rely on magic for ploughing and planting, as 7 men in every tithing were now under arms. But the crops got planted, if not as many as most had hoped. That's bitterly important for a feudal society. Disrupting the agricultural cycle, even for one season, could have disastrous consequences. The lambs still needed to be birthed, the cows milked, the chickens and geese fed, and the garden crops had to be tended, regardless of who marched where. I made certain that no region lacked the basic requirements to do so while their men were away fighting. According to the temples, that's the sort of thing a wise lord does. In addition to a long list of other responsibilities of nobility that usually only gets token service, for most lords, who pay attention to them at all. But apparently, such attention to detail does get you noticed, in some circles. I was asleep in my chambers at Spellgarden, Alia next to me, when an odd noise woke me, startled me awake. It was like the rumble of thunder or hoofbeats. The moment my eyes opened in confusion, a large figure appeared outside of the curtains, at the foot of the bed. At the very same moment, the megalith launched itself into the air above me, of its own accord. "What?" I began, automatically, as the sound rose to a crescendo, and the figure flared into proper existence.
"Alia of Vanador,"
came a deep but decidedly feminine voice from the foot of my bed.
"Arise, for you are blessed."
As I struggled with the sheets and blankets to grab a tool or a weapon or something, I glanced over at my wife, who was cowering under the sheets with just her eyes peeking over the hem, wide with fear. Then I tripped over the sheet and stumbled into the little table next to the bed and sprawled onto the wooden floor in a profoundly graceless fashion.
"Who are you?"
I demanded as the megalith lit up the room. It faced the figure defiantly, like a wary watchdog. As I asked, I took stock of the woman who had suddenly appeared out of thin air in the middle of the night. From my odd vantage point on the floor, it was a challenge. But she was a large woman in every way, easily a foot taller than me. Her shoulders were as broad as mine, and she had long legs and an abundant bosom under the fine leather cloak she wore. Her face was wide, framed by long, straight, dark brown hair that seemed black in places. Her eyes were big, brown, and deeply expressive, as were her lips. She was a very large woman, bearing a very serious expression.
"I am Bova, goddess of the kine," she declared proudly. "You have honored me, Lady Alia, by your careful devotion to my rites."
I realized that she bore a strong resemblance to her priestess, Milk Sister Dawnza.
"Bova?"
I asked no one in particular.
"The cow goddess? Behold my bovine glory, mortal,"
she demanded, flinging back her cloak dramatically as she spread her arms. She seemed to take up the entire room. The handmaiden was not happy about this, I realized, as the megalith rose in a challenge. I don't know what part of her bovine glory she wanted me to see exactly, but I couldn't argue that there wasn't a decidedly cow-like demeanor about her.
"Bova,"
I acknowledged tiredly. "Hail! Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know your divine salutation," I admitted sheepishly.
"Really, baker boy?"
she asked snidely.
"Bearer of burdens is often favored, as is the milk, mother. But I am here to honor your good wife, not you."